Hi, everyone. I'm Beth Daly, and I'm totally thrilled to I work at Inside Climate News, and I'm totally thrilled to invite these four award winners for SEJ's investigative articles. It's a pretty competitive field. If you don't know about SEJ awards, we get hundreds of submissions, and the work is really, really good. But some ultimately rise to the top, and you're sitting here looking at some of the award winners. And let me go through everyone, starting with Sharon next to me and to my left, and I'll tell you how we're going to run the panel. I'm just going to read because I downloaded everyone's bio. But Sharon Lerner covers health and the environment for The Intercept and is a reporting fellow at the Investigative Fund. Her work has also appeared in The New York Times, The Nation, and The Washington Post, among other publications, and has received awards from the Society for Environmental Journalists, hello, the American Public Health Association, the Women in Politics Institute, and the Newswomen's Club of New York. Her series, A Teflon Toxin, which she's also was an honorable mention here, was a finalist for a National Magazine Award. She also won first place for features for her investigative work, I think, for the strange case of Tenney White, right? Yes. Got that right. I thought I said that wrong. Next is Kyle. He's an environmental investigative reporter in suburban Bucks, Montgomery, and Burlington counties. His work appears in three papers with a combined circulation of 85,000. And before I go telling about their project, I'm going to introduce Jenny Wagner to his left, who is also an award-winning health reporter. Is part of the same team to Gatehouse Newspaper now, right? And I think they've won pretty much every journalism award in Pennsylvania for your series. And it's a long list, Unwell Water. And we'll hear a lot about that. And to the final left is Lance Williams, is a senior reporter for Reveal, focusing on money and politics. He's won journalism's George Polk Award not once but twice for medical reporting while at the Center for Investigative Reporting and for coverage of the Balco sports steroid scandal while at the San Francisco Chronicle. His resume is so long. I'm going to jump around, but Williams' reporting has also been honored with the White House Correspondents Association Edgar Poe Award, the Gerald Loeb Award for financial reporting, and the Scripps Howard Foundation's Award for Distinguished Service for the First Amendment. He graduated from Brown and UC Berkeley and has worked at the San Francisco Examiner, the Oakland Tribune, and the Daily Review in Hayward, California. So let's jump in. I'm going to ask everyone to give kind of an overview of their project that they won for, and in Sharon's case, too. And then with a focus on some tools they use that could maybe be transferable, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty and start talking about those tools. And I'm going to leave a lot of time for questions at the end because we have a full room, and I'm sure there's going to be lots of questions. So go to it.
Hi, everybody. I am so glad to talk to you all because I know we're here to talk about investigative journalism, which is, I think, sort of a redundant term because pretty much all good journalism is investigative, right? And I know that everybody has their methods for figuring out stories. So I'm going to talk mostly about these two different projects. One is a series called The Teflon Toxin, which is a series that for me began as what I thought was a story about Chris Christie in New Jersey, because I had heard that there is this little water board in New Jersey that had begun investigating, or not investigating, they were going to set basically drinking water standards. Very small, obscure, you know, just get the work done, small kind of, you know, go about their business group that had been operating for decades. When they had begun setting the standard for New Jersey for this chemical that was perfluorooctanoic acid, and I thought, what was this when I first was looking at this in 2015? They basically, a bunch of lawyers began showing up at their group, and they ended up getting shut down for a few years. And I thought, why was this? Very, very, very long story short, that led me, that chemical turned out to be the same chemical that was at the center of a class action lawsuit in West Virginia. And in kind of putting those two things together, I realized, oh, my story isn't actually just about New Jersey. It's about this chemical.
Can I join you for 1 second?
Yes.
One, there's seats up here, everyone, if you want to come to the front of the room. And can everyone hear Sharon okay?
We good?
Okay, good.
More? Yeah. Closer to the mic. Okay, sorry. Anyway, I began piecing together that this was a much larger story. And that story, and then I decided, oh my goodness, I ended up writing about the class action suit. I wrote about the fact that these chemicals had seeped out into the drinking water into a number of water districts in Ohio and West Virginia. And then I ended up writing about what happened with the EPA around these chemicals, which is, again, very long story short, not that much, which is to say they weren't regulated. So the first story turned into three stories, and those three stories, which were in 2015, turned into, I'm now writing part, I think it's 13, 14, 15, I'm sorry to say. So I keep thinking I'm done with this, and I'm not. But the pieces that, so the beginning of this story came from kind of just monitoring what was going on in New Jersey, and then in talking to attorneys, mostly in West Virginia, and then lots and lots more people. But it came from basically sort of regulation and lawsuits. But the parts that I got the SVJ award for are kind of down the line from that. And so this chemical PFOA was a big deal. Class action suit, it's still a big deal. But what ended up happening and what I brought out in these stories is that DuPont, the maker of the chemical, ended up replacing PFOA with another chemical because basically they came to this agreement with the EPA that they're going to phase it out voluntarily. So part of the agreement to phase it out was that they were going to kind of get some leeway in terms of, you know, space from the EPA to introduce its chemical, its replacement, which became known as Gen X, which is what I wrote about in, I guess it must have been last year, so 2016. And this chemical, which nobody really knew about, was actually in the Cape Fear River. That was, how did I get to that? That was one of these, much of what I end up writing about, I feel like is hidden in plain sight. There was an academic journal article about the fact that this chemical was in the Cape Fear River, and it had been out for a while before I wrote about it. But it was sort of combing through those journals and figuring out what it meant that got me to that story. But the part of that story that ended up, I think, really advancing the kind of whole picture of Gen X, which is now a very big issue, as probably some of you know, in North Carolina, where it's now in the drinking water of 250,000 people. So it kind of happened on, okay, they had this replacement. Well, what is this replacement? They've named it Gen X. What does that mean? And in talking to lots of people for my first few stories, I had gotten in touch with a scientist in Zurich who actually put me onto the fact that there was a chemical name for Gen X, and using that chemical name, I did another hiding in plain sight thing, which is I plugged that chemical name into a search engine, which is on the EPA website, and was able to find, I think it was 16 8E reports, which are adverse incident reports, and which showed that Gen X cause many of the same health problems that were associated with PFA, which led them to take it off the market. So, and now we know that, you know, with those toxicity studies, it was like, okay, they were associated with cancers, as PFOA was, reproductive problems, immunological problems. So that ended up being kind of, I think, moving this story forward. I could say a lot more about the Teflon toxin, but I think maybe I'll go on to the other story, the feature story, which, I think pretty much all stories are investigative. But this story was a weird one. And I'll talk about Tenny White, who is an environmental activist in Mississippi who ended up going to prison for almost 3 years, and she was prosecuted by the EPA. And the way I got to that story was, and I think I learned from the process of getting to this story, which was I was in Mississippi. I had basically had stumbled across a very small wire story about the fact that the EPA and the Department of Justice and a company named Anadarko were about to close what was the biggest Superfund deal in history. It was a paragraph about this, like, okay, huge, right? And there is this line in this paragraph that said, you know, all the party, I don't remember the wording, but basically everybody's good with it except somebody in Columbus, Mississippi. So, of course, I'm like, what? You know, what's in Columbus, Mississippi? I was going to be in Mississippi for another story. I ended up finding the person who was, you know, took issue with this settlement, who was a pastor in Columbus, Mississippi. He was an hour out of my way, met with him, and we had a long conversation in which he explained that, you know, his property had been contaminated. He felt that he was frustrated with the EPA for a number of reasons, felt that they were getting more of the money than they should, that the people who were in the town weren't getting their fair share. And in the course of that conversation, he mentioned to me, I think his words were, they got one of ours. And I said, what do you mean they got one of yours? You know, and he ended up explaining that an advocate for their community, which was a low-income, mostly African-American community, had gone to prison and been brought up on what he thought were trumped up charges. And then he wanted to take the conversation back to, you know, and my, you know, my yard has, and I was like, what? You know? And I guess from that, I've had a number of these, I'm sure you all have too, these moments when you go, wait, what? You look at that and you go home and you think, what? And so I kept thinking like, this is, unfortunately, his situation of living in a contaminated community and going through a cleanup, that I'd heard about before. And, you know, it's pretty common, unfortunately. And I'm always wanting to write about it. And I'm always wanting to try to figure out how you write about it without doing it the same way. And so I thought, let me go figure out what he's talking about. And it turned out to be very difficult to find Tenny White, who had been, she was in federal prison, she got moved. And I ended up tracking her down, writing to her in prison, explaining that I wanted to talk to her. We ended up having a series of 15-minute conversations, because that's the amount of time she could spend on the phone from prison, in which I tried to understand. It took me like 9 months, because how did this happen? What, you know, and it was very, very, very confusing. And I guess I would just say my lesson from that was, you know, sometimes you get a story doesn't make sense, and that's because that's not really a story. And sometimes the story doesn't make sense, and that's because it's really complicated, but it's really worth understanding. And that really took me months and months of talking to her and then combing through lots of records to trace back, you know, try and verify what she was saying, that led me to be able to tell her story, which is in the end a story about a Superfund site in many ways. And it's a story. And so basically she had been advocating for this community, trying very hard to get regulators to appreciate the fact that the people she was representing, who lived in this town of Columbus, had been exposed to creosote from the Kerr McGee plant nearby, right? And so she went through the usual channels, and she, you know, contacted the Mississippi DEQ, and she was getting nowhere. She ended up going over their heads, going to the EPA, you know, making tons of noise, writing letters, you know, and she ended up finally getting folks from the EPA to test the soil and find that it was quite contaminated, and it became a Superfund site, $67 million cleanup. But she pissed off everybody along the way, and which I thought ended up being relevant to the fact that she was prosecuted by the folks who testified at her trial were the Mississippi DEQ, who she had made huge enemies of, and also a company that she had made enemies of. And I think I'm probably out of time, right? So thank you.
I actually failed to thank you. That was totally – I'm excited to talk more about it. But so Kyle and Jenny are going to talk about – I just mentioned the Unwell Water series, but I just want to tell you that it was a two-year investigation they did that looked into the leaking of chemicals from a nearby military base into an aquifer that polluted the water of tens of thousands of people. I just didn't give you everyone a heads up about it, so go ahead.
So my name is Kyle Bagenstos. I'm an environmental investigative reporter for the Courier-Times and Intelligencer in suburban Philadelphia. Jenny Wagner is my colleague. So our series actually focuses on some of the same chemicals that Sharon's great work features on, which is PFOA and PFOS. They were typically, you know, her series is the Teflon Toxic. They were used in PFOA was used in Teflon, but they had all kinds of applications. One of them was for the military, used it for firefighting foams going back to the 1970s. And this is becoming a nationwide issue where the military is coming to grips with the fact that probably dozens, if not hundreds, of their bases, they use this foam in exercises and spray it all over without containing it in a lot of cases. And now it's getting into water supplies. Our situation is one of the worst in the country for this. About 70,000 people's water supply was impacted with public wells being shut down, and some of the highest levels in the country. I just want to preface by saying I've only been doing investigative work for about 2 years, so don't have the breadth of experience of some of the panelists here, but I think Jenny and I were talking. We'll just say how we did this story and what tools we used, and hopefully that will be helpful to people, especially daily or you know, regional or smaller newspaper reporters. So our cover paper was actually covering some of the contamination issue before our investigative team formed, but covering it kind of straight news without enough resources. They kind of just went to the meeting, reported on the well closures, and left it at that. When we came in, there were a couple things early on that just kind of tipped me that this might be an issue. The really big tool that I used was the EPA's UCMR program. It's called Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule. It's a mouthful. But about every 5 years, the EPA will go and pick out several dozen chemicals or so that are unregulated that they want to test or require large water utilities across the country to test for, to see, you know, how widespread is it, what kind of levels are we dealing with, is it something we might want to move towards regulation on. And that database is publicly available, and we pulled it out. It actually crashed Excel, so you have to put it in Microsoft Access. It's so large. But if you play around with it, manipulate it, you can sort it by chemical and then sort it by the contamination level for the specific chemical. So I saw these weird chemicals, PFOS, PFOA, did that, and I realized that we had three of our towns all had top 10 readings in the country for it. So that was a huge early data point that, wow, this is not just typical contamination. And the thing that kind of we cross-referenced that really made the story interesting was looking, okay, what are the illnesses linked to these chemicals? The science is still kind of new, but a particular few cancers like bladder cancer, kidney cancer, testicular cancer, and some other health illnesses. So every state just about, I think, has some kind of surveillance program, their health department, tied to varying extents. We're lucky that Pennsylvania has pretty detailed where they track several dozens of kinds of cancer all the way down to the municipal level, and you can also break that down by age group. The downside was that it wasn't digital. It was PDF, so we had to manually input the data. But once we did, we realized that of, I think, 50 towns in our county, Bucks County, the worst contaminated community had like the third highest bladder cancer rate. And the first two were kind of small towns, which probably was like a statistical outlier. They had like two cancers and that gave them a really high rate. So, and we're not epidemiologists, but we started playing with the data, looking at, okay, well, maybe there's a lot of old people. Well, there were a lot of old people, but when we looked at just, you know, elderly people, they also had really high rates of bladder cancer. So speaking with some health researchers, we're able to kind of, you know, I think responsibly say, you know, could this be potentially caused by that? And what happened once we did that, we like it kicked the stone over on like several decades of concern in the community. Wouldn't you know it, there was a Facebook group with like 400 members that were just focused on thinking there was cancer clusters around the bases that our paper just had never hit onto until we did this. I highly encourage people to, if your state, check out what surveillance data they have, how far down you can drill it. A couple of other applications I think might be useful that are kind of related. So obviously anybody can go into the UCMR and you can sort it by chemical. If you're a national reporter, maybe you can see some chemical that hasn't gotten a lot of coverage. Maybe it's really high in some obscure town that hasn't been covered. So there's a story. vice versa, if you're a local person, you can see your towns in that list. Do we have any unregulated chemicals in our water? Kind of a shortcut for that, the Environmental Working Group, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with that, just this past year launched a public tap water database where they basically found as much data as they could on what's in community water systems. So they'll start with, like, you know, the annual report that the water authorities have to send to their customers, which is all the regulated levels. But they also took, like, UCMR and other data sets. And so you just punch in your zip code and all your water authorities nearby will pop up. And what's really cool about their database is that they'll show the state, national averages, and then the local level. So, okay, so maybe there's some arsenic in there, and that's not necessarily a good thing, but it's lower than the state average, so maybe a story. But if you go in there and see, wow, there's a really high level compared to the state or national average, you know, what's going on here? Maybe there's a source. So that's a way to maybe try and draw out a story. I think Jenny's going to talk a little bit more about the health data. But just another application, like I said, I recommend, especially if you cover a county or some kind of region where you've got a certain number of towns, if you can get your hands on data and just go back 5-10 years, just look to see what's there and what trends are. Obviously, there's just going to be a random chance some towns are going to have higher cancer rates without any particular source. But one of the interesting things that I used that also for another application was a story on air pollution. And so there was a part of our county where we had our offices, actually, that has really bad air pollution. And so, of course, like the 4 or 5 towns in this area, they had high rates of lung cancer, and their lung cancer rates are trending up and to the right. So it was kind of like, you know, it's hard to correlation causation, but you can at least show we do it. Something is driving high rates here. But it was really interesting that one of those towns, it was actually declining. It was like one of the only towns in the whole county where it was dropping. And you tracked it back, and it actually dropped, sort of precipitously dropping, right when the U.S. steel plant closed back in the 90s. So, yeah, must be a coincidence, right? So once again, yeah, you can't prove causation, but you lay that out and you show, okay, there's really high lung cancer rates in these communities with highways and factories and landfills. Oh, but one of them in the midst of that is dropping, and it just happens to have dropped since the U.S. steel plant. So that was kind of, I wasn't even looking for that, but just looking at that data, it got a really interesting point. So a couple of things I want to get into, but I think I'll pass on for now.
Okay, so kind of going off a couple of the things that Kyle just mentioned, the data, I think the biggest thing with that is the visualizations that we used really just kind of brought to life those numbers. You know, being able to see on the maps, you know, we pulled all that municipal level cancer data, and it wasn't until we had really plugged it into these kind of custom municipality maps that we could really see they were heat maps, so you had the higher concentrations actually were directly correlated with where the contamination was located. In regard to those bladder cancer rates, we found that in one of our communities, Hatboro, which was a municipality that actually wasn't even included in the ATSDR's cancer cluster study, they had a bladder cancer for the age group that Kyle was talking about was 81% higher than the state rate. So those visualization tools, like we use Infogram a lot, we use Google Maps to map all of our well data for where the contamination was found, where wells were shut down, things like that, has really just taken the reporting and also the resources for our readers to another level. This stuff is, you know, sometimes virtually impossible for us to understand. For them, you know, it can be even more difficult depending on, you know, their knowledge of these kinds of things. A lot of those tools, I really can't take credit for. IRE has been such a resource for me personally. We've had newsroom trainings, and also I've gone to conferences. The Excel trainings, the Access. I mean, Access. When Kyle started looking at that, I was like, "Well, I've never used it before, but I have it, and like, let's try this." And I mean, it's really been kind of a learn as we go experience for some of these things. But like backgrounding, that's definitely a skill that has come into play so many times throughout this, like finding people who have worked for different agencies through LinkedIn searches. Really can't just say enough for some of those IRE tools that I've picked up along the way. As far as like the couple stories that Kyle touched on, I would say there was. And Sharon, Sharon's comment about the really complicated issues, but they're really worth understanding. I think that has been key to a few of the pieces that were part of our package that we submitted for the award. One of the things was the health assessments that originally we had looked at kind of in the beginning of the project for the bases in our area were the most recent ones were done in 2002. And really, there were no conclusions about health hazards at that time. But there was all this science and all this information that had come out in the meantime about these unregulated chemicals and the fact that they were present in drinking water. And there was no kind of attempt to go back and update those and take a second look. So that was a really big kind of, I think, important piece in our reporting was the fact that we weren't just like kind of going off of those old documents and those old kind of statements and really kind of questioning, well, what now and where do you go from here? And so, you know, that kind of ended with, we also looked at some other communities that had gone through this, like Camp Lejeune. They had done a health assessment more recently that included these chemicals. So we were able to kind of use that as a wayfinder to say, well, how should a health assessment have been done or should it be done, you know, in the future to really include some of these things that really could have put people either on the base or in these surrounding communities at risk. So kind of looking for the other communities that have gone through things has been another huge piece for us for the biomonitoring where they're basically, you know, there's other communities that maybe it hasn't been related to military bases, but they've received blood testing and health studies related to other types of contamination. And really going to them and saying, was this useful to you? Because what we kept hearing from the ATSDR and other agencies was that blood testing and biomonitoring wasn't really valuable. And, you know, to hear that from someone who received blood testing and maybe has a really high you know, level in their body, was a totally different story. So, you know, while they might not actually be able to do anything about it, at this moment in time, you know, simply knowing something about yourself and about your body and what's, you know, what you've been exposed to, I think, they definitely said was important to them. So, we also, with that cancer cluster, information that also led to, another second look that the state has said that they're going to go hopefully do soon. So there's been some real advances, I think, in the discussion just based on some of that reporting and not really taking the science, you know, at face value.
And I also failed to mention, thank you, that's great, that's great, and we'll talk more about it. I also failed to mention Lance's story was that he won for and his team. It was the best named investigative series I think I've heard of. It's called the Wet Prince of Bel-Air. And they sought out to, during California's crippling drought, to find out who was using the most water, you know. And I'll let him tell it.
Sure. If you've been in the business long enough, you've had this experience before. You have this great idea for a project or a story, and you know there's documents or data that will absolutely allow you to nail it. And then the unhappy day comes when you find out they're not going to give you the information. And the typical response, the normal response to that is to go work on something else. But with my partners, Catherine Miskowski and Michael Corey, I'm here to tell you, doesn't have to be that way. Sometimes you can find a way to write true and compelling story about an important topic, even when they won't give you the data that would allow you to absolutely nail your story. That's what we were, that was sort of the arc we were on. We wanted to write about residential water use during a bad drought. Back in the day in California, this was a standard drought story that you ran off the city desk at the paper, and that's because for decades, utility bills were public record. So you could just get that and do that. And I remembered, gosh, my old paper, the Oakland Tribune, long after I had left during a drought in the 90s, did just some great stories on that topic, very powerful stuff. And so when Catherine and I were tasked to do some drought stories, I says, why don't we do that, you know? But you can't, we found out, because the tycoons of Silicon Valley in the 90s got the state legislature to put all that utility usage data under a cloak of privacy, probably out of fear of terrorism or something. But anyway, they did that, and so we couldn't get the info. And so really the project, which went on off and on for 3 years, it was trying to figure out ways to backdoor the info, trying to find soft spots in the Public Records Act revision itself to try to get you at what you wanted. And we came up with these really creative, really clever attacks, and almost all of them failed. One that worked, and it was in year three of the drought, just sitting reading the act over and over again, we saw that there was one soft spot. The utility bills of officials who set water rates were not exempt from disclosure. And that turned out to be every mayor and city councilman in the state, because that's how the water district typically was run by the city government. And so we did Public Record Act requests on the top 25 water districts. And this is going to shock you. These guys who were approving these apocalyptic public service announcements, water is life, don't waste it, we're all in this together, historic drought, state crisis, and the same guys who were approving finding nobody's $500 for using the wrong nozzle when they wash their car, some of those same guys were using like 1.5 million gallons a year on their landscaping, and it made a hysterical story. The excuses that they had for what they were doing were just beautiful, and it was a great story. It was, and Catherine and I thought, okay, we're done. This was in year three because everybody said El Nino was coming, and that was going to blow the drought away. And then when El Nino didn't come, we had to go back at it. And then it was again looking for ways in to get at what we really wanted, the names and faces of the big mega users. And finally the day came where we had this discussion and one of us said, all right, it's privacy. That's the problem. So we'll just take privacy off the table. We'll tell them we don't want the names of the water users. We don't want their addresses. Just don't give us any of that. Just give us the data of the water use itself and the zip codes. And then the other of us said, okay, but what the hell kind of story is that going to be? But we said, well, we'll just try it anyway. And as my grandma in Ohio used to say, my God, thy God, we got the data back, and there were people up in Bel Air and Beverly Hills using enough water for 90 or 100 families, and there's this one guy that we called the Wet Prince, Andy Donahue, our editor named him that, using 11.8 million gallons of water a year. It's just unbelievable. And the way we attacked the story then, what kind of story is that going to be? We were right up front. We don't know who it is. We blamed the government secrecy, and we laid that out. And then we, against it, just to offset and maybe make a point, we could get the names and addresses of all the schmoes that had, like, watered their lawn on the wrong day of the week. And so we went to some of them, and Catherine got to this guy who had been hit with, like, a $600 fine because his sprinkler malfunctioned. And she shows him the list of redacted water bills with the 11.8 million gallons, and that's the guy, and he didn't do anything wrong, and you're getting fined. And this guy practically went nuts. The story we were talking beforehand, I think it's the government allocating a scarce resource in an unfair manner that just drives people crazy. Anyway, the story was it blew really high. Steve Lopez is the brilliant columnist at the LA Times, the local columnist, and he wrote two columns and did a video, and he organized a drought posse. They were driving around Bel Air like looking for, you know, water in the gutters. It was hysterical, and dang, you know, we got state legislation and so forth. It was a great story, even though we didn't know who it was. We didn't have any of the information we set out to get. The story really worked, but I was positive that story was going to get us a leak, not the plumbing kind. It was going to get us, somebody was going to give us the water bills for the Wet Prince. I knew they would. And Lopes, he knew they would too, except he was positive he was going to get them. You know, he's the columnist and so forth. But we didn't get a leak. Instead, we got a tip. This doctoral student in geography had read the stories, and he called up and he said, you know, you could probably figure out who's using all that water up there. And I said, how? And he described basically the methodology, he shorthanded it for me, that my brilliant data analyst colleague Michael Corey used, the use of multispectral satellite images that show up that when combined with an algorithm can give you a reading for plant health of a particular region, and then a separate mathematical attack that could give you soil moisture. And I listened to this, and I was positive it could be done. But I was also positive as I sure as heck couldn't do it. So we went over and talked to Michael, who's just great, and he had was a somewhat familiar with this from doing some stories on forest fires, doing mapping on forest fires. So he had, and he was willing to give it a go. And he also brought in this third mathematical attack using some tools that landscape architects use, so he could actually get estimates of how much water was needed to maintain plants at the health and soil moisture level that existed. And overlaying on the satellite map was the assessor's parcel map. It was really slick. But you know, Michael's scrupulously accurate. He lives in fear of making a mistake. And I think part of what he gets up in the middle of the night worrying about is getting teamed with some cowboy reporter who's going to want to push the findings past what we got. And he was, I could tell, he was worried about me. And it took a while. It took a while to say, look, we're not going to write anything we don't know. Look at the wet print story. We didn't have it. We didn't say it. We're not going to do anything that you're not comfortable with. And on that basis, you know, we went forward. But I think he was still worried. And finally, it came time, you know, we had picked the parcels. I had worked up the users and was trying to call up the billionaires now and see what they wanted to say for themselves. And again, you'll be surprised, you know, not all of them wanted to come to the phone. But I got the former head of Warner Brothers on the phone, and he was a good guy. You know, he was like, yeah, you know, I got a big property. I'm sorry. We're trying to do better. We're doing this and that and this and that. He was a good guy. And I finally said, well, so how much water are you using up there? And he said, well, about 4 million gallons. I took that to Michael, and his face just broke into this beatific smile because, you know, he was doing this analysis, but he didn't have anybody on the outside, any data points affirming what he was doing. But his estimate for this guy's water use was 2.6 to 4 million gallons. And there we were, right at the top end. Michael was happy. I was happy. And that story blew almost as high as the other one. We even got on Good Morning America, if you can imagine. They played it for complete laughs. They sent this Brit tabloid reporter up to Bel Air, and he's like jumping up to look over the hedge at Mr. Perinchia's estate. It was just comedy. But we didn't care. By then, we had gotten the state law passed and got all our... So we were just having fun. Anyway, at the end of it, the producer was on the phone, and he said, that was a great story. And I said, yeah. And he said, but isn't that a little lowbrow for you guys at the Center for Investigative Reporting? I mean, you know, really? And I said, dude, you have no idea. So...
That's great. So I'm going to ask a question, maybe two. I just had to also apologize. Sharon has to leave early at 11:45, but I do want to allow the audience to ask her question. So I think I'll ask one question, then open it up, and I think you will have questions. If you don't, I have many. But I have a question about revealing what you know and when you know it, right? Like traditionally, when I would write a series, we would kind of wait 2 years and write a series, you know, and then and pop it. And things are changing, and it seems in all these cases you had to make a calculated decision about when to write something, and you do that writing to inform the next story or reveal something. So talk about the pace of when you decide to write something. And I'll start with Sharon, because Tenney was very different than Teflon, I imagine.
Yeah, well, with Tenney, I mean, I knew there weren't really firm dates I needed. And there weren't other reporters on it. I couldn't imagine anyone went down that weird rabbit hole that I did. But with Teflon, I've definitely had the weight of, for instance, Kyle mentioned the UCMR, and unfortunately, I don't know if you know this, they're not collecting PFOA and PFOS in the current UCMR. But anyway, I was also onto the UCMR, and you can see so much. And so I was looking and around the country and saying, oh, they have a problem here and there and here and there. And I was thinking, like, do I call local reporters all over the country? Because I saw it. It was like, you know, and we actually did a map of, we did a firefighting foam story in 2015 where we, and here's the reporting tip for you. I wanted to find out all the fire and crash training sites from the military where they had used this firefighting foam. I didn't know how to get it. And so I called them and I asked for it and they gave it to me. So that was really like, whoa, you know. So we used that. But also, so we actually did this overlay map and I heard from, there was a team at Harvard that had been working on it. I guess they didn't ask the same guys. But anyway, we were able to see all these problems and it's hard. People still are saying, why didn't people alert everybody earlier about, I get this call from North Carolina where people are drinking Gen X. Why didn't they alert us? And the weird thing is, like in a way you could say, I could have called everybody. It was sort of before the EPA made this change their levels and the official problems, the number shifts of who officially has a problem. But the weird thing is that, I didn't end up calling everybody. I did try and do a national story and point them to the, to that database. But the really difficult thing I think about this issue is that the, info is out there in public sources, mm-hmm. And so it's like, you do want to do these local stories and say our water is an issue. But really what the EWG is trying to say, and what I feel like I'm trying to say sometimes in my stories, is the water is an issue everywhere. And you do need to be and it's really difficult to alert people to anything beyond the general that is an issue. Because like for the contaminants we're talking about, they're not officially even a problem, you know? I don't know if that answers the question.
No, it does. I just want an addendum, and then but when do you decide to actually publish something and then publish the next? No, I want that answered first, the first part too. But I'm curious.
We don't generally do the wait so much till it pops. So for the next three pieces, I think we're going to put them all out together. But I think it's. As soon as you possibly can, really, because I feel like, it's as soon as you can get it out there, because hopefully that's not really much of an answer. I don't hold on to things longer than I have to, though. I have to say, like, in terms of the tools that are important to this work and I feel like with the wet Prince of Bel-Air, the tool, and for me too, the critical tool is time. And, in order to actually get to the point where you can tell the story you need to do, sometimes you still are grappling with the questions and you don't know the answers to them. So it's like, I guess when you feel that you, it's not an adequate answer, but when you feel you know enough to like, to stand by what you are saying.
It's been kind of a learn as you go process. This is one of the first major projects that came out of our investigative team forming. So as an organization too, local organization that hasn't dedicated resources to this kind of stuff before, we're kind of still, I think, trying to figure out what's the best way and best timing to do stuff. The first story, it was just kind of like, got it out there. Well, let's see what happens. And within like days, you had congressmen talking about it. And it was kind of like, buckle up, since then, it's just, and especially because, we have other responsibilities to do as well at work, daily and sometimes weekly kind of story responsibilities. So ours is really similar. Get it out as quick as we can. I think at this point, we're a little more strategic and thinking maybe two or three stories down the line. There's so many angles to pursue. Do you want to pursue military? Do you want to pursue the companies? Do you want to pursue just local interest stories? Do you want to pursue solutions? So, and there's so much limited time. But we try and think, you know, maybe two or three stories out in advance, and basically as just soon as we can get to them and feel like we've got the story, then we'll go with it. I think one thing we've learned along the way was, especially communicating with the military, it's like this obviously really huge organization where some people move quicker, some people are helpful, some aren't, and they take forever on answering questions. So we learned pretty, I don't know if it's an intentional strategy or not, but it was like, we'll have your answers in 2 weeks. And then, you know, they never came. Maybe you can come more days, they're still not there. And if we get those answers, it's a month or two later. And so we realized early on, you know, you give them what we think is a fair amount of time. If the story's otherwise together, it's gone. So.
Yeah, and I think with those stories, we did end up, you know, running follow-ups when we got the answers, maybe months later in some cases. Like, in terms of individual stories, finding the right sources, especially with our health reporting, has been really important. You know, a lot of communities, places I've lived, even have people say there's a lot of cancer here, there's a lot of this illness or that illness, and you know, it wasn't good enough to just say, oh, well, all these people on this block. I mean, we got tons of you know, emails and correspondence after some of these stories ran, and that said, oh yeah, like, you know, all five of my neighbors have, you know, cancers, everybody in my family, something like that. So we really had to be selective in who, you know, who we used in our stories, made sure that we had health records, made sure that we were talking with their physicians, really kind of making sure that there was research behind some of those health conditions that at least had probable links to these chemicals, so that, you know, you can't say for certain what something is caused by, but, you know, it is more probable than not possibly for some of these people. And so we wanted to make sure that we knew that they had possibly consumed contaminated drinking water or worked on the bases at a certain point in time or whatever. Those kinds of factors were really important. And then waiting kind of for the smoking gun, if you will, has been, you know, something I think that we've had to just kind of move forward with stories, even if there's not really information that feels conclusive or information that maybe tells the whole story. And so we've kind of, I think in our more recent stories, we've been telling parts of the story and kind of giving more and more information. And, you know, maybe it will eventually lead somewhere, you know, to something more conclusive. But until then, we've just had the strategy to get as much information out as possible when we have it.
Do you guys ever play solitaire? I mean, an investigative project has aspects that are similar to a solitaire game. You've got 6 or 7 ideas that you tried, see if they produce what you want. It's a little like going through that solitaire deck. When you start seeing the same card 3 and 4 times in a row and you can't make a play, well, that's probably time to cut the cake. So that's the way we think of it anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, when did you decide to, I mean, you didn't have the top water use, right? You guys would strategically use that lack of knowledge to kind of write a story that got you.
Yeah, well, when we, on the wet print story, when we knew, we had tried everything we could to try to get a name and try to write fairly and accurately. I mean, we could have written a speculative story. I mean, Mr. Parencio, the guy that Michael proved was using so much water up there, he was an obvious person in Bel Air just because of the size of the property. You could have speculated in that second story, but we didn't want to do that. We didn't want to be unfair. We got to the point where we weren't going to know. We didn't even have a good faith belief. We said, well, let's go ahead without the names, you know, and just see how it looks. Like I say, one of us was pessimistic, but when we tried it, writing it, it actually held together pretty well. So
that's good. So I'm going to start opening it up to questions. And so you guys know the rules. SEJ members first, identify yourself and your organization, and speak loudly. So, and I have other questions if they don't come. So, go ahead.
My name is Daniela Cheswell. I'm the editor of Weekend Edition at NPR. And I was wondering, if you were stationed in Washington, D.C., what would you focus your investigation on right now on environmental topics?
National people want to
take that.
Well, I mean, I don't know that it would be different. I'm in New York, and I think of my beat as national, though I sometimes do international stories too. But I don't know they'd be different from what I'm thinking about, really, unless you're talking about doing local DC stories, which I don't think is what you're talking about, right? See, which is to say, then what am I working on now? But yeah. yeah, I'm definitely thinking about post-storm stuff and lead and some of the follow-ups I'm doing and a couple of climate stories, and that's not very useful. I'm sorry.
Can we clarify, does she mean what national stories are we doing or what areas local to the D.C. area?
Wait, no, she means national stories.
Yeah. You know, President Trump is portrayed as being ineffectual. He can't get a law passed and so forth. But in terms of appointees to key agencies, he's very effectual in changing the way business is done in these agencies. And I'm interested in that. I'm interested in who's being appointed and what they're doing once they're in there, because it's a different breed of cat.
Yeah, and I have been writing about that.
I think one of the really interesting things I learned in our project, so these were chemicals for like unregulated, unknown, obviously. And one of the really big, like, wow moments for me was that traditionally, you know, industrial chemicals in this country haven't been tested thoroughly before they're put to market. So people have confidence that, you know, if something's in our environment, it's probably safe. And so like cosmetics, pharmaceuticals have some kind of testing, but this doesn't. And the Toxic Substances Control Act, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with this topic, but I just think that that's something that was apparently, you know, beefed up towards the end of the Obama administration. But I think it remains to be seen how effectual that becomes. And just from a, you know, it's kind of our interest area, but from a drinking water perspective, that's just like a really big issue. And I feel like, you know, there's so many issues right now, obviously, with the environment and the Trump administration, that that's just one I haven't really seen a whole lot of really in-depth reporting on what's happening with that now. So I think that would be one of the first areas I would probably look at.
Anyone has a question for Sharon in particular, just because she used to leave in like 4 minutes. But if you don't, then we'll go on. Sharon, here you go.
Louder, I'm sorry. And repeat the question.
When you do an investigation, it hopes that you found something outrageous. But what do you do when there's like one level removed from outrageousness or like immediate harm? And it's more like you're talking about risk and uncertainty. How do you deal with that, especially in science investigation?
Right. Well, so the question is about dealing with risk and uncertainty and also writing about things that aren't, you know, immediately obviously outrageous. And I guess risk and uncertainty is just that. That's what it is. That's what I write about, risk and uncertainty. Because, you know, it's nebulous. And this is part of, I think, what my strategy has been to, like, embrace it, like deal with it head on. The fact that it's impossible to know, and then, you know, and so with, for instance, I just did a story in St. John, Louisiana, where the and here's a really useful tool: the National Air Toxics Assessment from EPA. Use that data, scrolled through it. Because I'm miserable at Excel, I literally scrolled through it and found, you know, while the average nationwide in terms of the risk of death from air pollution per million is between 0 and 1. There is a place in Louisiana and virtually like all over the country is between, it's either 0 or less than 1 or, you know, very low. There's a place where it was, I think, 800. And it was just like crazy off the charts. But even when you went there, so you have, this is very much based on fact, there's inventory, like the EPA calculated this risk, and yet no one had done a health study. So you go down there and you get what, you know, we've been hearing from Jenny, you know, or and others, you know, on my corner, you know, this person has cancer. So kind of embrace, like, you can't say for sure. But I did talk about the people who said, you know, five people in his family, five people here. And it matches, and it does match up with this prediction of risk from the EPA, which is based on these chemicals. And it happened to be a community when I went to that census tract where they had this ridiculous estimated risk. In fact, not only were people saying they were sick, but it was also next door to a plant that emitted, it was the only plant in the country that emitted this chemical that was related to these cancers. So you can't, even then, that is not a sure thing. But I think it helps just to say, to delve into it. Here, we don't know, but here's what we do know.
If I can add to that, the C8 science panel, which came out of the Mid-Ohio Valley with the DuPont cases, those are very early research on that. And, you know, those chemicals were not definitely linked to these health effects. I mean, it was more probable than not was the assertion. And, you know, in talking with the researchers and you know, determining what is their baseline, how did they make that assessment was really helpful, you know, in allowing us to, like, make our own kind of connection, I guess, or links. And then, like, also risk and uncertainty has kind of been a way that I've kind of seen some of the agencies and regulators not have to deal with the definite, you know, hazards and harm. You know, the fact that these are emerging contaminants, there's not enough research to know what can happen. So that's a way to avoid really saying, like, yeah, you know, you've been drinking something that could really hurt you someday. So,
And I mean, and in cases where the data is there and it's not really necessarily compelling, maybe, and I would say it's maybe just not a story. I mean, if it's not there. There are cases, like, I think there was a nonprofit that put out a big report about chromium-6, which is like the Brockovich chemical over the year. And suddenly, and it was something like it's in every water system in the country. It was, you know, not quite that dramatic, but it had people really worried and they don't know what's in their systems. And so able to taking a look at that data for the local systems, it was a chance to be educational as well, because then we could explain that the safety level is based on risk, which is kind of this, you know, difficult thing to explain anyway, and go through and explain, okay, so this is a level in a local water system and it corresponds according to the math to this much risk. And you just kind of use that as an opportunity to educate, not necessarily like investigate maybe.
Good. Who is up next? I think over here.
Sources and things like that, and if you do, is there a risk of, you know, tipping your story or tipping what you're exploring?
I have to leave, so thank you. And sorry, I have to leave. And I don't really use Twitter much for reporting purposes, but and apologies.
Oh, that doesn't reach. You know, it depends on the story. I don't remember if I mentioned this earlier, but one of the first things we discovered after we ran the initial story, I think I did mention this, but there was this Facebook group on there with like 300 veterans of these bases that had think they had been made sick by the cancer, and there was a local residence group as well. So I think that was absolutely a huge tool and a huge time saver for us to be able to find people and go into those groups. But that was like, you know, Christmas. Like, it was just sitting there. They had to do a lot of work. I haven't had especially at a local level where you're doing local news, I haven't had a lot of success with Twitter or Facebook for sourcing, just because the pool's small, if you will. But I have thought before about, depending on the story, absolutely where the temptation was there to use it and to try and get somebody. But I tend to be pretty cautious and not wanting to tip. You know, usually I like to have a lot of pieces in place before having a chance that the subject is going to know that we're working on it. Subject in investigation.
LinkedIn for journalists is a really amazing training that has helped me as far as social media. So being able to kind of create custom searches and identify people who became sources for us pretty early on with like toxicologists and epidemiologists and people who had maybe worked for the EPA but were retired. So we weren't really maybe as concerned about them not being willing to talk with us. And, you know, you do have to be really cautious when you're, you know, meeting people. But we also could, like, meet with people in person, you know, maybe reach out to them via a private message. I do that a lot with I'll search through with some of the Facebook groups. Like, we can actually search for a term. So if we're looking for, say, like a, you know, a firefighter or a airplane mechanic or something like that, a lot of times people will introduce themselves on these Facebook groups, and then you can search for some terms and be able to reach out to them personally. And I find a lot of our medical sources that way too.
Anything? Yeah, sure. Yeah, you got to be careful you don't give your story up when you craft your query. I last year did a project on student debt, and a lot of the info, a lot of the people in the story, I got off YouTube. I mean, you can reach out to somebody who's posted an autobiographical video and say you want to talk. And so, yeah, bring it on.
I'm just gonna, if anyone else has any thoughts in that audience, I'd be interested, because I'm going to add two things to that. I did medical reporting before I came sort of back to the environment reporting, and to find patients, it's very useful on Twitter and Facebook and Yelp and Reddit. You can find people, you can email directly, right? And so it's very useful to go on Reddit looking for people, because you can email them, and you can, same thing with LinkedIn, obviously, but that's more professional, and Yelp too, to find bad businesses or people who had experiences. Anyone else?
Hi, I'm Sydney Pereira. I'm not currently with an organization, but I just finished an internship at the Miami Herald. I studied public health, so I've read like hundreds of these studies, and all of these studies that epidemiologists write, they always get all this data from hospitals of like 10 years and, you know, I'm sure hundreds of pages of data. So have you guys ever been able to get data from hospitals and their records, and is that even possible because they're not?
I mean, I did a project on a bad healthcare chain, and we used Medicare data extensively. And I mean, it's a subset of a hospital's total patient load, but you could get an awful lot. I mean, the patient ID is masked, but you could get lots of stuff that way. And I think that's what the real guys who do this work use extensively to draw conclusions about patient care issues.
So for this Unwell Water series, we have reached out to a lot of the hospitals and individual physician practices in our area. I mean, no one really has had a firm grasp on these chemicals, including you know, some of the doctors who are based right around the military bases where this is most concentrated. So there really hasn't been any data to get from them. As far as just other stories like that I've used, nonprofit hospitals, at least in Pennsylvania, have to, I think, well, maybe nationwide, I don't know. Community health needs assessments are required every 3 years, I believe, or annually maybe. And those, they do provide a lot of data for their service area. So I've gotten a lot of kind of localized, I mean, and we're coming from a local approach too, but that's been helpful.
Questions? So the question is, how often do they rely on legal counsel before they publish a story to make sure it's covered?
Yeah, organization, I believe they're we have them on retainer, I guess, a firm. And we've had to do that with a couple of the bigger stories, that especially with the early ones where we weren't really weren't on firm ground necessarily yet with the story, ran that by. But yeah, any time that we think there's a potential question, that's something our office definitely, our newsroom definitely looks to do, is make sure we're in good shape that way.
The center lawyers all its projects. We had a board member who's our attorney as well. They recently just hired somebody to work in the newsroom with us and also do public record stuff. We were of course, considering suing over our water stories, the reason we didn't was there was this really promising lawsuit that the Desert Sun newspaper of Palm Springs had filed with the First Amendment Coalition as counsel. They wanted golf course water consumption. In Palm Springs, that was a great story. And they had been getting that data right along. And then when this drought came, the water district stopped giving it out. It looked like a dead bang case. I mean, it wasn't private people, it was companies. But they got a judge that was sort of like Mitt Romney, corporations are people. He applied the privacy exemption to the golf courses. And at that point, we said, well, we're not going to make much hay here. But yeah, lawyering stories let you sleep at night.
Questions? Well, I want to ask one first. I'll be right back with you. But like, several people in the course of this last couple of days asked me, like, so how do you get ideas, right? Like, and I just want to just quickly, like, where do you get your ideas? And it's not just the one you did, but in general.
Yeah, well, there's two kinds of stories, right? There are tip stories and hunch stories. This was a hunch story. I bet we could get a story if we went after that, and that just came from, you know, reading and thinking. The problem with tip stories, but also the good part is that they're kind of binary. I mean, here's the tip. Is it true? If it is, boom, right? But the downside, of course, is it's less of a possibility for fallbacks. Hunch stories, you can always gin up some fallback story if you can't figure out what you really want to find out. But that's where they come from. Sometimes they come from editors. Can you imagine?
So, you know, for stories that either, like, we do hear a lot from our community, so, and being on the ground, you know, really helps to identify things that are important to them. But for other types of things, like, if I do want to see something, you know, I do want to get something that maybe hasn't been brought to light in our community, different, professional associations and affiliations have been really helpful. Like, for me, Healthcare Journalists Association has been a real resource, just really kind of localizing any type of national story. I mean, that's our strategy for a lot of things.
Yeah, I think what I've learned here is I think a big challenge in environmental journalism, at least as it relates to public health, is that people just don't really grasp it, right? Like, they know not exercising is bad for them. They know eating cheeseburger every day would be bad for them, but they don't understand, oh, if I go out near a highway during rush hour, I'm going to inhale air that's bad for me. Like, some people, you know, intuitively know that, but a lot of people don't. So I think I've kind of like to focus on the data sets. So seeing whatever data I can get on what is the levels of contaminants in communities, especially ones that, you know, might be an environmental justice situation or something like that. And then trying to get the health data and trying to connect dots for people and have them understand why this is important. So normally I just go, especially some of that data sets I mentioned earlier, your water systems, you know, everything in Pennsylvania, we've got radon, air, I mean, whatever you can get your hands on in terms of data to see, just go back to that well, where are their stories, where are their trends?
Any question?
Yep. I'm Ariel Breen. And like, what were some of the similarities or geographic differences?
Could you repeat the question too?
Yeah, the question was, I guess, how did we determine that the levels were high in these particular communities compared to other ones? Is that right? Yeah. So I think I mentioned earlier, Bucks County, which is our primary coverage area, has about 54 municipalities, and we also cover Eastern Montgomery County, which adds another 12 or 13. So, you know, at least in the county, you just get the data for all those and just do the work and figure out what the levels are and try and find similar communities in terms of size and income and others, you know, so you can have a bit of a control, if you will. You know, like I said, we're not epidemiologists, and a lot of times we rely on those experts to say, is our work at least like the first two steps that you'd want to do in something to look at, like, correct and try and make sure we're on good ground that way. So that's really a lot of the comparisons. And then obviously you can just, normally it's a lot easier to find your state and your national average levels for for things. So that would be, you know, I think CDC has a lot of that data. States, I'm going to guess, have a lot of variation in terms of how helpful they are, how much they provide. But I think states, a lot of nonprofit organizations, American Lung Association, things like that, will have that, a lot of that data, at least to the state, if not down to the county level as well for you.
Grabby, right with you. Someone just texted me an answer to the lawyer question. What I just wanted to mention too is that a lot of if you're a freelancer or if you're working for a publication that doesn't have like a lawyer, there's this happened for my last job it was a small nonprofit in Boston, is that we had a pro bono lawyer. We would ask someone who worked in First Amendment rights to go over the story, and they were very willing. So I just wanted, someone had mentioned that. So I'll mention that. Go ahead. Can you identify yourself?
Oh, sorry, yeah.
Sorry.
I'm Rachel Lonsack. I am an intern at Nature magazine, but before that I worked on a couple stories with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism on their water series, Failure at the Faucet, drinking water strictly, so this is for you too. Wisconsin has a lot of privately owned wells, which are, you don't have to monitor your well, so I don't know if you guys are dealing with that kind of issue or how you guys address it. I mean, I know how the center addressed that or kind of went after it, but how do you handle that in your state, like, or in your district?
Yeah, we do have a lot of private wells affected. And so it was a challenge because we were so focused on the public water system, because it's easier and B, it's a larger population. So at one point we just had to kind of set aside, so we need to do just a story on the private well owners. And it turned out to be, I think, a really good one, because those people get left by the wayside a lot of the time because they're on their own. And so also there's a military base in New Jersey, McGuire Air Force Base, and they're just they're pretty far along at this point now. But we pretty quickly, as soon as we did this story in Pennsylvania, we're like, well, what's going on over there? And they were almost entirely private wells around there. And we had to ask like some really tough questions, and they didn't have good answers. And it was one of those things like, well, you're jumping way ahead of the gun. We need to test this first and then track it off base. And they actually called us like activists because we're asking hard questions. And then like 2 months later, they were testing the wells off the base. And I like to think that we precipitated that a lot quicker than otherwise would have been, just by showing the theoretical situations, even though the data wasn't there, that it theoretically could be possible.
We're running out of time, but I think we have time for one more question. And I know you had two, but I want to give an opportunity to someone else. Does anyone else have a question? Okay, then you're up.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so my other question is, with the center, we have like a very, very intense fact-checking process for our stories, and I'm just kind of interested. I really enjoy the fact-checking process, like you have receipts for your stories. And I just want kind of interested in what that looks like in your newsrooms.
Lance, you want to take that one?
Well, I usually do an annotated version of a story, so I know where everything came from. That's what I do. You don't want to write it that way often because it's so horrible. But and it's great to have that memo and that annotated version for later. Right now, I mentioned a student debt project I did. More than a year ago now, Reader's Digest wants to do a version of it, of all people. And they're like, well, where'd you get this? You know, and I was like, actually, I know where I got that, but I sure wouldn't if I hadn't saved all the stuff, you know?
Yeah. So with like the digital presentations and inline links, that's become a lot less like cumbersome. You don't necessarily have to have all the little, you know, references and stuff like that, but we definitely try to link back to any kind of previous stories that maybe explain a lot of these things that we've already established in our coverage, because that's been really difficult. You don't want to restate the facts every single time, because we've had just hundreds of stories at this point. So linking and fact boxes where we've kind of given people a roundup of what we know to date, FAQs, things like that, so they can kind of actually go and explore it a little more on their own, and we're not kind of wasting inches and that kind of stuff on reiterating some of this stuff.
Yeah, and just quickly to add, I mean, an honest take is that it's a challenge for us as a newsroom, like many, you know, that have had positions cut and everything. You know, we just have to be really careful, and there might be seven reads, and maybe we'll have to do two or three of them, like after, as it just goes through the process, and continuing to make sure, because we don't have a formal, you know, team or fact, you know, checking desk or anything like that. So a lot of it is just us and maybe at least one, maybe two or three editors engaged in that process. So we just have to be really careful.
So I'm supposed to tell you two things. One is lunch is served. So get there quick because we have a tight schedule. Sharon also wanted to tell everyone if you had questions for her specifically, she's happy to help. And her email is easy to find, but it's sharon.lerner@theintercept.com. Okay. Thanks, everyone.